This show is a Hopful Media podcast production. Wait, wait, wait. This one is Trevor. I still have other stuff to promote. Do you like ancient mythology? Do you like coffee table books? How about the periodic table? Have you ever really wanted to have my writing in print for some reason? I recently contributed to a periodic table of Greek mythology, along with over 120 other classicists, to create a cool book covering a huge range of historical and mythological characters. Even Xerxes is in there. Personally, I wrote the article on Cronus, the primordial god of time, a Greek deity who will be surprisingly important on the history of Persia. This project was organized and published by Working Classicists, an organization that promotes and supports making classical studies available to everyone regardless of their socioeconomic background, and all of the proceeds go to supporting their efforts. You can buy your own copy of A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology at contubernalesbooks.com. That's contubernales books.com, or wherever books are sold. If you Google A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology, you'll probably find it. This is a great project supporting a great cause. Go check it out. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 142, Gauls with Gaul. Last time, we covered the chaotic aftermath of Seleucus Nicator's death. Ptolemy II Philadelphus has successfully seized control of most of southern Anatolia and all of Coel Syria from Damascus to the Sinai. Our Seleucid king Antiochus tried and failed to subdue the various minor kingdoms and city-states of northern Anatolia, only really succeeding in starting a Bithynian civil war. Then everyone's attention turned to Greece, as a sudden and unexpected invasion from the north tore through the Balkans. Gauls from Central Europe invaded and plundered Thrace and Macedon, permanently destabilizing the Odrysian kingdom and creating an opening for Antigonus Gonatas to reestablish his family as the rulers of Macedon, but only after the Gauls tore northern Greece apart. An Athenian-led coalition with tacit support from both Antigonus and Antiochus tried to hold the Gallic chieftain Brennus at Thermopylae, only for the same battle plan as every other battle of Thermopylae to play out, with Brennus circumventing the pass. Only after a perfect storm of literal storms and earthquakes were the Gauls so disrupted outside of Delphi that a smaller Greek force turned them back, killing Brennus in the process. Despite that defeat, other Gallic bands were still happily plundering their way through Thrace, even as the Greeks and Macedonians celebrated. And that is where we pick up our story today. Modern scholars disagree on the exact timeline of events here. For example, John D. Granger seems to place today's story entirely after Antigonus Gonatas pursued and defeated a band of Gauls near Lysimachia in Thrace. That was 277 BC. Many other sources I've found, like the extremely useful timelines on Attalus.org, portray today's Gauls as largely separate from the band defeated by Antigonus. Either way, one of these Gallic migrating groups was led by Commentorius, and they were intent on establishing themselves as a territorial power somewhere in southeastern Thrace. They seized the city of Tylis and established a small kingdom for themselves before turning southeast once again. Commentorius's Gauls made a new habit of beating the gold out of the city of Byzantium. For all intents and purposes, the Greek city on the Bosporus became an abused Gallic vassal, with raids into their countryside every year for decades after this point to force them to pay an annual tribute. Then the Gauls would return to Tylis. This forced the Byzantines to ask their neighbors and allies all around the region for financial aid, some of which came from Heraclea Pontica, but this also brought the military effectiveness of the Gauls to the attention of King Nicomedes of Bithynia. Nicomedes had been locked into a civil war with his brother, Zipoites, for almost 2 years now. Zipoites was receiving support from Antiochus to keep him in the fight. If Antiochus had all the time and resources of the Seleucid Empire behind him, he probably could have conquered Bithynia without much trouble. But as we saw in the last episode, the Seleucid king was stretched thin as it was. So supporting Zipoites was the best he could do in this case. Nicomedes wanted to turn the tide, so he offered a deal to the Gauls of Tylis. He and his allies in Heraclea would provide passage across the Sea of Marmara and allow the Gauls to settle in and around Bithynia. In exchange, they had to serve as Nicomedes' allies and allies of his descendants, and they had to promise to aid these new allies no matter who else was involved, even if that meant making peace with the Byzantines. Specifically, these allies of Nicomedes seem to have been the nominal members of the Northern League, even those like Pontus that had largely withdrawn from the ongoing war with Antiochus. Commentorius didn't personally make the crossing, but some of his men did agree to these terms, and from what we can tell, they generally abide their agreement with Nicomedes. Several ancient sources reference that the Gauls' signature brutality carried over into their attacks on Bithynian cities while battling Zipoites II, but even Memnon, who was from Heraclea Pontica, lays equal blame on his own people for sacking those cities. The sudden infusion of new troops met Seleucid reluctance to get more involved in the Bithynian War. Early in 278, there was a naval standoff between a few ships of the Seleucid Navy and the Heracleans, but neither side was willing to actually fight the other, and eventually they just sailed away. So when the Gauls arrived, they tore through the countryside in Zipoites' territory and gave Nicomedes the openings he needed to defeat and execute his brother. With Bithynia once again in the hands of a single king, Nicomedes might have had some suggestions for where the Gauls could settle. But overall, he lost control of the situation, and the Gauls burst out of Bithynia to raid, pillage, and extort much of northern Anatolia. Oddly enough, the most realistic description of their forces comes from a source I don't think we've seen before. Titus Livius, better known in English as Livy's History of Rome. When describing the Gauls' arrival in Anatolia, Livy says that they brought 20,000 men, but that only 10,000 were warriors. Not only are those pretty realistic numbers, but they point to the reality of why the Gauls wanted to cross over in the first place. This wasn't just a violent raid looking for treasure like Brennus' attack on Greece. The Gauls who signed on with Nicomedes were promised land. This was a settler migration looking for a new home. They were also happy to carve out that home from the northeastern Seleucid Empire by force if necessary. These settlers came from three tribes: the Trachmi, the Tolistobogi, and the Tectosages. On their initial arrival, they did have two overriding leaders, probably better understood as agreed-upon war chiefs, but there were intertribal and even intratribal politics. And after helping to reconquer Bithynia, the three tribes agreed to strike out in different directions. The Trachmi went to the northwest, along the Sea of Marmara and the Hellespont. The Tolistobogi were sent southwest, into the Greek regions of Ionia and Aeolis. And the Tectosages plunged south into the land of Phrygia. Ilion, built on the site of the legendary city of Troy, had no walls and found itself sacked and occupied by the Trachmi, who briefly used it as a base of operations before moving on. The city Kizikos was apparently hit simultaneously by the Trachmi and the Tolistobogi, as both tribes ransacked their farms and countryside. The city became temporarily reliant on financial aid and food from Philetaerus, the vassal ruler of Pergamon to their south, who was dealing with his own Tolistobogi raiders, albeit more successfully. At least in this initial phase, the Tolistobogi were the most financially successful, though probably also the tribe that had the most trouble finding anywhere they could actually settle their families. They got to raid the wealthy Greek port cities of Ionia, exacting tribute from cities that preferred to just pay them off, and raiding as far south as Miletus, where they plundered the Temple of Apollo at Didyma, recently the home of vast treasures donated by Seleucus Nicator. They also kidnapped and brutalized a group of Milesian women celebrating a religious festival outside the city walls. The threat of kidnapping, assault, and ransom was very real and widespread across the region, as recorded in a number of Greek inscriptions at the time. Priene put up heavy resistance, sending out the city militia to drive the Tolistobogi out in one of the few pitched battles from this time period. In unwalled places, like the Pisidian town of Themisonion, some people chose to flee and hide in caves. Others, like the Phrygian palace at Kallinae, got lucky and had a natural disaster, in their case a flood, disrupt the invaders. This initial barrage of Gallic raids happened in late 277 and 276 BC, and caught all of western Anatolia unprepared. King Antiochus was even in the area with a royal army, directing his troops in every direction from the old palace at Sardis. But there was so much going on that he wasn't able to respond quickly to a new threat. Remember, for every story of a rebellion or a battle with a minor kingdom I was able to briefly describe in the last episode, more vague sources imply that there were two or three uprisings and disputes that we don't have recorded by name. Unfortunately, we simply don't have much detail about the Gallic attacks either, but we do have some information. And I will address that and how Antiochus ultimately resolved his Gallic problem after a quick break. Wait, wait, wait. This one is Trevor. I still have other stuff to promote. Do you like ancient mythology? Do you like coffee table books? How about the periodic table? Have you ever really wanted to have my writing in print for some reason? I recently contributed to a periodic table of Greek mythology, along with over 120 other classicists, to create a cool book covering a huge range of historical and mythological characters. Even Xerxes is in there. Personally, I wrote the article on Cronus, the primordial god of time, a Greek deity who will be surprisingly important on the history of Persia. This project was organized and published by Working Classicists, an organization that promotes and supports making classical studies available to everyone regardless of their socioeconomic background, and all of the proceeds go to supporting their efforts. You can buy your own copy of A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology at contubernalesbooks.com. That's contubernales books.com, or wherever books are sold. If you Google A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology, you'll probably find it. This is a great project supporting a great cause. Go check it out. Although these Gallic attacks would ultimately contribute to more conflicts and unrest down the line, in that moment, the threat of foreign invasion seems to have given Antiochus the opening he needed to bring Western Anatolia in line under his rule. Modern historians cannot agree on when exactly Antiochus settled the problem, with possible dates ranging from 275 all the way to 267 BC. On one hand, you do have to allow enough time to pass after the three tribes left Bithynia in 277 for them to actually do all of this raiding. On the other hand, if you push the end of these Gallic attacks too far, you get a very odd timeline where Antiochus abandons Anatolia to the Gauls for several years and comes back later, even though he and his army were already present when this all got started. In this instance, I agree with John D. Granger, who also argues that the only date that makes sense is 275. Though I guess you could extend that into early 274 if you really want to choose a different year. We know roughly nothing about the Seleucid-Galatian War. The sources that first recorded it are mostly lost, as are most of the ancient secondary sources that described it in detail. Thus, we are left with references from poets, or even references to references from poets, and brief descriptions in the rhetorical works of Lucian of Samosata to pry the details of Antiochus's final confrontation with one of the Gallic armies out of the jaws of history. Given the Gallic style of raids and skirmishes, and that their warriors were now scattered across the peninsula in small bands by 275, Antiochus's army must have had many smaller encounters with the invasion. These battles would have put increasing stress on the tribes, especially the Talistobogi, who were ransacking some of Anatolia's wealthiest regions. Eventually, Antiochus forced at least one of the tribes, again, likely the Talistobogi, possibly with some aid from the others, into facing him in a pitched battle described by Lucian in his pamphlet on the ancient painter Zeuxis. In all likelihood, Lucian was probably describing what he thought a battle in the East would look like at this time. But hey, it's all we've got. So, as he tells it, the Gauls adopted elements of the Hellenistic phalanx to combat the Seleucid army, arranging themselves with their best armored warriors in the front line, cavalry on either side of the infantry, and a screen of war chariots, both those armed with scythes and those without in front. Interesting to note, this is the first time we've seen unscythed chariots in a really long time. I think it's been since Xerxes? Maybe Artaxerxes I? Antiochus had to rush to get any force at all into position, and he was nervous about facing the heavily armed Gauls because his own army was composed almost entirely from light infantry. These were probably skirmishers and archers drawn from the upper satrapies. Less than half of them were fully equipped phalangites, and Antiochus had very little, if any, cavalry with him. However, a Rhodian general named Theodotus offered a compelling strategy. They had 16 elephants with them, and rather than putting the elephants in front of the front line as usual, Theodotus proposed a smaller version of the Battle of Ipsus, holding the elephants in reserve just barely out of sight from the battlefield. In a different pamphlet, Lucian says that Antiochus dreamed of Alexander the Great telling him to use the word health, hugeia, as their initial signal to call for battle. So that's what they did. When the Gallic chariots and cavalry charged, the Seleucid officers yelled, "Hugeia!" and the infantry parted to send the chariots careening past them without much injury, a tried and true Greek tactic for almost 200 years that the Gauls would likely have known to expect. Then the elephants charged in, crossing in front of the Seleucid phalanx and into the middle of the battlefield before the cavalry and the chariots could actually reach the Seleucid army. Parting the way was just to make everything seem normal. Four of the massive animals intercepted the cavalry on either flank, while the remaining eight caught the charioteers in the middle. Up to this point, neither the Gauls, nor more importantly, their horses, had ever seen an elephant up close before. I've talked about how terrifying this would be to an inexperienced soldier before, but the Gallic horses panicked, even more disastrously than their riders. Cavalry horses turned and bucked and ran into one another, sending their riders to the ground, while chariot horses turned and crashed, entangling with one another, sending the charioteers careening over the sides of the wagon. Worse yet, some of the scythed chariots were still intact as the horses turned around and sprinted back toward their own side of the field. That meant that the scythed chariots were suddenly hurtling toward a completely unprepared Gallic phalanx. And for the first time that we've seen in this podcast, the scythes did their work, carving a bloody path through their own army. In the chaos, all but a small band of Gallic warriors were killed or captured, and Antiochus was celebrated for his victory. He was declared Antiochus Soter, the semi-divine title of savior once given to the likes of Antigonus Monophthalmos, Demetrius Polyocrates, and Ptolemy I for their accomplishments in the Wars of the Diadochoi. The newly christened Antiochus Soter was able to leverage the news of this battle and his large number of Gallic captives to negotiate with the other tribes. All three of them were given land in the rough highlands of central Anatolia, where they could settle and integrate into Mediterranean society. Of course, this came at the expense of the local Phrygians, but Antiochus basically picked the most sparsely populated area in the region and sent the Gauls there in hopes that they would settle down and become Seleucid subjects. The newly established province was called Galatia, or Galatia, and thereafter its new settlers were called Galatians, or sometimes the Gallo-Greeks by the Romans, to distinguish them from the Gauls of Europe. So if you've ever heard of Galatians, like the biblical book of Galatians, this is where those people come from. This only had about half of the intended effect. Raids along the Mediterranean coast mostly stopped after the elephant victory, which is why I suspect it was the Tolistobogi who were defeated, but raids didn't stop in their entirety. We still see inscriptions referencing Galatian raiders for almost a decade after 275, but to an extent, that's just the nature of inland Anatolia under imperial rule. We saw this with the native peoples under the Achaemenids, too. So long as everyone held up their military and financial obligations to the larger empire, there was a lot of wiggle room to raid and fight your neighbors. The long process of Galatian integration was just the most extreme extension of this. Remember, they were still trying to carve out their place in the region to the detriment of its existing inhabitants. The Seleucid rulers were left to do a delicate balancing act. They needed to both placate the Galatians and keep them from completely overrunning Anatolia, and prevent their tacit approval of Galatia's existence from inciting further rebellions out of the existing inhabitants of the same area. One way of dealing this was to direct Galatian raids out of firmly held Seleucid territory. Several of the known raids after 274 were in Caria and Cilicia, territories which were still disputed between Antiochus, Ptolemy II, and local dynasties. The other strategy was decrease the number of local targets vulnerable to Galatian raiders through a program of micro-urbanization. A number of new cities named Antioch, Laodicea, and Apamea, in honor of various people in the Seleucid family, were established around this time. The Seleucid governors, Docios and Lucius, as well as Antiochus's brother Achaios, all set to work establishing and fortifying cities in their own regions which were vulnerable to Galatian attacks, especially those places along the Royal Road in central Anatolia, roughly the area directly south and west of the new Galatian province. Often, these new cities weren't really new, although a couple of them were. Many of them were existing villages that were just renamed and fortified with walls, as well as a new Greek-style layout of the central downtown sort of area. These new cities featured Greek amenities like theaters and baths to attract colonists from the west. Overall, this was successful, and Galatian raids largely came to an end within the decade. That was helped, in part, by both the Seleucids and all of their neighbors recognizing the Gauls' military talent. Galatians, Thracian Gauls, and Gauls from northern Macedonia all became regular fixtures as mercenaries in Western Hellenistic armies for the next 200 years. All of this turmoil in Europe and Anatolia that we've talked about in these first few episodes of Antiochus's reign had far-reaching consequences for Seleucid history. On a more local level, Antiochus's failure to subdue even one of the breakaway kingdoms in the northeast gave them all time to solidify their territory and establish plans for succession. Armenia, Pontus, Cappadocia, Bithynia, and Heraclea were all here to stay. Likewise, just managing so many fronts at once required delegating vast amounts of authority to Antiochus's subordinates. Some of these were just powerful associates of the royal family, like Prince Achaios and Lucius. Others were increasingly autonomous city-states, like Pergamon. Basically, political turmoil after Seleucus's death fast-tracked the empire right back to the problems that had plagued the later Achaemenids in the same region. In foreign affairs, having to spend the better part of a decade at war in Western Asia effectively killed any plans Antiochus might have had for continuing his father's work to conquer Thrace and Macedon. This was especially true after the Gallic invasions, which left Macedon in the chaos of a succession crisis, because they had moved on to threaten Antiochus at home. Antigonus Gonatas exploited that situation to consolidate his authority in Greece and press on to Macedon from the south and the east. In 277, he defeated the Gauls in Thrace and used the support he gained there to seize unchallenged power in Macedon, after murdering a few rivals. In a bit of royal family tree bending that would make a Habsburg blush, Antiochus and Antigonus arranged a marriage pact shortly after Antigonus occupied the Macedonian capital. Antigonus was still unmarried and had no daughters to exchange. So the usual interstate dynamic went out the window. Antiochus was undoubtedly the more powerful king, and if he didn't have anything else going on, he probably could have defeated Gonatas in an outright war. But instead, he sent Phila. Phila, you might remember, was both Antiochus's half-sister and his stepdaughter, thanks to the unusual sequence of events around Queen Stratonike. Phila was also Gonatas's niece, so sending her to Macedon was, in a way, restoring the marriage alliance between the Antigonid and Seleucid dynasties. It also meant that Antiochus formally recognized the Antigonids as the rulers of Macedon, and he relinquished any Seleucid claims to their ancestral homeland. Within a year or two, Phila gave birth to a son, another Demetrius, and the Antigonid dynasty was seemingly secure in its position, in no small part because Antiochus was willing to let them settle in. In the years that followed, Phila became a prominent patron of religious institutions, particularly the Temple of Apollo at Delos, and a whole temple complex on Samos, just off the Seleucid coast. Though the story of how an Antigonid queen wound up being so important on an island that is currently Ptolemaic territory next to the Seleucids will have to come back another time. Speaking of another time, that is where we will leave things today. The year is 274. Anatolia is finally at peace, more or less. And good thing, too, because that's just the moment that Ptolemy Philadelphus chose for a war against Antiochus. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia. Wait, wait, wait. This one is Trevor. I still have other stuff to promote. Do you like ancient mythology? Do you like coffee table books? How about the periodic table? Have you ever really wanted to have my writing in print for some reason? I recently contributed to a periodic table of Greek mythology, along with over 120 other classicists, to create a cool book covering a huge range of historical and mythological characters. Even Xerxes is in there. Personally, I wrote the article on Cronus, the primordial god of time, a Greek deity who will be surprisingly important on the history of Persia. This project was organized and published by Working Classicists, an organization that promotes and supports making classical studies available to everyone regardless of their socioeconomic background, and all of the proceeds go to supporting their efforts. You can buy your own copy of A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology at contubernalesbooks.com. That's contubernalesbooks.com, or wherever books are sold. If you Google A Periodic Table of Greek Mythology, you'll probably find it. This is a great project supporting a great cause. Go check it out.